This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Welcome everybody to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today is part one of two episodes on the Xenomorph from the Aliens franchise.
Whoop whoop.
Yeah, finally, doing a big one. We said right at the start we were going to tackle this eventually, and we've built up to it. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. We're going to have time codes below so you can skip ahead to the bits we're looking for. But before we get into any of the science, my name's Sam Perrin. I am a freshwater and invasion ecologist at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, writing my PhD thesis. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside Adam Harsick, who is a disease ecologist at the University of Arkansas. We're your movie ecologists, and we're joined every week by co-host number two, Dave, who is a vet and our movie physiologist. I've finally recovered. I've been sick all week, which is real fucking shit, but, you know, it's fine now. I was just kind of at home and miserable and not really able to concentrate for any long periods of time, but it was fine. I've just been sitting at home doing a puzzle all week, like the oldest white man in the book. Taking up bird watching. I'm doing puzzles, I'm doing board games.
God, you'd fit in right with these Tumblr girls.
What can I do for you?
Don't talk to me that much. Never lie to me and never, ever touch my puzzle.
Let's get started. Like I said, we're looking at the Xenomorphs from Aliens today. For those who don't know, there was a film in 1979 called Alien, which did reasonably well. A film of some notoriety, I believe I can say.
Huge cultural touchstone.
And then Aliens, the sequel, came out...
86.
Oof. Back in the day where you couldn't count on a sequel coming out 2 or 3 years later.
Or at all. Completely different movie too.
And look, they were big movies. If you haven't seen them already, you don't need to have seen any of the others today. We're really not going to go too much into the aspects of the physiology or biology that are presented in Prometheus,
Alien Covenant,
Alien 3, Alien Resurrection, Alien versus Predator, Alien Cubed. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, we're not going to go into any of that sort of stuff. We're just going to go through the aspects of the aliens which are brought up in the first two movies. So for those of you who haven't seen those two, Dave, do you want to kind of take us through what people need to know about the plot and the background of the first two movies?
Sure. Very quickly, the first film deals with the crew of the Nostromo that, while on a return trip back to Earth in this large processing ship, end up detecting a transmission from LV-426, the planet that sort of becomes known. They end up investigating the signal only to find a crashed alien spaceship. At this point, humanity has not encountered any other form of life outside of Earth in the universe. And on the ship, they end up finding a series of eggs, which end up hatching, leading to the release of an alien creature via impregnation of one of the crew members. At the end of the first film, Warrant Officer Ripley is able to blow the alien out of the back of the ship into the vacuum of space, and setting off the second film, which starts with her being discovered by a group of salvagers out on the outside of the universe 56 years in the future.
See, we were obviously all, you know, children of the 90s, and we grew up knowing about these twists, like the classic thing at the start of Terminator 2, when, you know, you find out that Arnold's the good guy in this one. And we grew up knowing these things. I would have loved to, you know, like, not known about these things that everybody knows about the Aliens films upon seeing them.
Yeah.
Finding out that Ripley's woken up and, oh shit, 60 years in the future.
It's a huge, yeah. And finding out that there are other colonists that have started living on LV-426.
The company specifically put them there.
And after she gives testimony, giving them the exact coordinates where the alien ship can be found, the colonists are sent to explore, leading to transmission signals stopping from the colony and leading to a group of space marines with Ripley in tow heading to the planet to try and explore what's going on, which, spoiler alert, they find that the aliens have created a hive, which forces Ripley to take on the queen in a fight scene, which is so epic, it defined much of my childhood.
Yes.
I grew up with these films. These were two of my dad's favorite films. He named our cats Ripley and Bishop.
That's awesome.
When we were little, and in the main playroom area where we had our TV, we always had a statue of Ripley in her classic robot suit standing power lifter. On the top.
Were there any kind of big scenes where it was, you know, like a human in a mech suit going around kicking ass before then? Because that I can think of a lot that have come around since.
I can't think of any.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Alien and Aliens were pretty big cultural touchstones, but like Aliens itself really set the stage for like sci-fi going forward as far as the idea of a space marine. Anytime you see a space marine in a video game or a movie from here on out, they look exactly like the Marines in Aliens. The ones in Halo, the ones in Starship Troopers, they all have that same template, the same characters, the same wisecracking, cigar-smoking black sergeant. The sergeant in the Halo games is an exact ripoff of Sergeant Apone in Aliens.
And in Halo, there's always this cowardly Marine in the background who's always, like, worried and freaking out, and it's just Bill Paxton's character.
Hudson.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, the first film was a huge success. It ended up winning multiple Saturn Awards. It ended up getting Hugo Awards and has a place in the Library of Congress as selected for a culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant film. And it is widely regarded by a number of different groups, including the American Film Institute, as one of the best films of all time.
It's also one of those movies, much like The Exorcist, that it was the first of its kind. Like, nobody had seen something like this before.
No.
So, like, so scary, so visceral that people would be leaving the theater, especially, like, during the chestburster scenes, because of how gruesome it was compared to what people had seen before that.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the cast didn't know that that was going to happen, right?
Nobody knew. Nobody except for the guy who had the rig on. They knew something was going to happen, but they didn't know exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, you would think that John Hurt would know. That'd be... imagine if they hadn't told John Hurt what was going to happen. It was just... it started happening in the middle of the scene.
Yeah, the practical effects in these movies are incredible.
Yeah, let's not... there are a couple of scenes in this film where the special effects are fucking awful.
Which?
Only a couple. But when the little chest bursters come out, but when it runs away afterwards.
Okay. When it slides off on a rail.
It's clearly somebody with like a puppet on their hands just like scuttling across the floor. And also there's a really bad switch with Bilbo Baggins' head. Ian Holm, the actor who plays Bilbo Baggins, is the evil android in the first movie.
Ash.
Yeah. There's a great scene where his head is like... They're doing the whole below the table thing because they've got the seven android head.
Yeah.
And before they switch to like the shot of him clearly in the table, they've got like a wax head that they've built up.
It's a switch between frames.
Yeah, it's really weird. Most of it holds up really well, but there's a couple of moments where it's like, oh yeah, this is the 70s.
But it's just, it's making things work. I hadn't realized until I was reading through a big history that the eggs themselves, you know how you see something moving inside of it when John Hurt shines the flashlight on it? Apparently, that was done post-production, and it's actually Ridley Scott fluttering his hands inside
fingers,
of the eggs.
Yeah.
Do you know what the material in the eggs is? That nasty looking, like, muscly goop that's inside the egg when he opens it up. And kind of, it's raw chicken.
Oh.
Really?
Raw chicken breast.
Cool. Ah, nasty.
But I just thought, like, it's kind of fun to think of the director actually getting down and, like, putting his hands inside this egg and being like, yeah, I'm going to flutter these around. Yeah. Like, they don't have a cast member. They don't have, like, some random intern or anything like that. The director's actually doing it, which is just...
It was a real small movie. They didn't know how it was going to go.
And then a cool sort of side point for the second film. So the Marines were made to read a novel before they prepared for the role. That novel was Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
And they were actually pushed into military training, which they ended up doing for 2 weeks, which was apparently where we got, like, it was one of the first times they'd ever done that. And now that's just standard, right? If you want to make a movie with Marines, you get your actors to do Marine training.
These Marines actually do display tactics that, you know, you would think of people would be using as opposed to those guys in Starship Troopers where it's just everybody run in a certain direction for a while and then...
Live ammunition in the middle of a
so
camp.
So fucking stupid.
Dear humanity, we regret being alien bastards. We regret coming to Earth.
And we most definitely regret the Corps just blew up our raggedy-ass fleet. Hoorah!
Anyway, we should actually probably talk a little bit before we get into what we think of these about what the Xenomorph actually is.
Sure.
Just like an overall description. You've probably seen what they look like. I don't think we need to describe to them.
Spiky.
I think what we should describe is the life cycle really quickly. So one of the horrifying things about these organisms is that basically they're birthed from eggs. Out of the egg leaps this weird like kind of crab creature with a tail that grabs onto your face, wraps its tail around your neck.
Colloquially known as a face hugger.
Hugs your face. Not the sort of hug you're going to enjoy.
Not a good hug.
Probably talk to HR afterwards, maybe consider shifting companies. But, yeah, big thing goes right down your throat. And that is one of the things that, that they had emphasized early on. The design of the face hugger and the forced oral penetration was supposed to make male audiences feel really uncomfortable.
Which definitely does.
Yeah, which it really fucking does, yeah. It's also one of the reasons that the Alien vs. Predator 2, which features the Predalien almost exclusively doing it to pregnant women and having them, like,
yep,
burst out of the stomach, it kind of takes away from, like, yeah, the original intention of these things. Anyway, but what happens is out of the stomach bursts chest. A... out of the chest, yes, my apologies.
Breaking the ribs.
Although that would make a lot more sense. Just go a bit lower down and there's no rib cage to break through.
This is true, but having that visceral sound of the ribs snapping as this thing is trying to get out is one of the most horrifying aspects of it.
But anyway, bursts out of the chest, as a chest burst does, and grows very quickly to something that's probably a little bit taller than a human.
7 foot.
They're a lot taller than a human.
Well, they're not a lot taller than Shaq.
They're shorter than Shaq.
They crouch, but they've got the long black tail, the elongated head, no eyes are visible.
Shoulder tubes.
They have a secondary jaw that their primary jaw opens up, and then they have a secondary mouthpiece that extends and seems to be able to puncture through a lot of different subjects and seems to be the primary means through which they eat, although they're not really seen eating, something we'll talk about as we go through.
And then they just go around killing shit.
And there do appear to be multiple versions in terms of the ones that we see that are sort of defined throughout the two movies we're going to be talking about are the drones and the queen.
Yep.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it.
I admire its purity.
And that's, yeah, that's it. So, anybody dislike this film?
God, no.
Fuck no.
Yeah, okay. I'm just throwing it out there. Okay, we all enjoy these two films, obviously, but one or two?
That's really tough. They're both very different movies.
They're both fantastic. And I mean, yeah, two is subjectively a better film.
Agreed.
You think so?
Better production, better actors.
Yeah, moves the plot better, better budget. One has points where it slows a little bit, or there's kind of moments where it doesn't hit these like peaks of action and intensity. It's a very like slow draw throughout the movie.
But you don't think it's a lot more suspenseful and kind of like on edge?
The first one?
Because I never really feel on edge with Aliens. I'm always like, whenever I've watched Alien, I'm always like, shit. Like I don't get that from Aliens.
The tensest you could say that Aliens get is maybe when Ripley's making her way down to the Queen where she knows that Newt is, and she's slowly making her way down this staircase, and there's aliens all around. She's trying to get out of there, but threatening the Queen by burning the eggs, and that's pretty tense. But by and large, the first one's a horror movie with some action elements.
Yes.
The second one is an action movie with some pretty horrific parts.
Yeah. There is that wonderful, wonderful scene, boys, in number two where... And this has been done a lot since. This is another one of those scenes that's been ripped off by a bunch of other movies where they've got all the aliens just swarming towards them on the radar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they've got, because they can't see anything. And then someone looks up at the roof.
And it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoy seeing Paul Reiser die in this film.
And of course, these films went on to inspire a whole number of other films.
Books, movies.
Yeah, comic books. The comic books are great.
Games.
And these done to death in pop culture.
Yeah. We're only going to be talking about Alien and Aliens. We're not going to be talking about the terrible third movie or Alien Resurrection.
Hey.
Predator versus Alien.
Three's awesome.
We'll brush over it briefly next week when we go into, like, you know, the history of the Xenomorph in film. But apart from that, we're not looking at the physiology or anything like that. So.
Nah.
Let me just say, if aliens wind up implanting eggs in my chest or something and I eat one of you, I'm sorry.
I do not want another single pop culture reference out of you for the rest of the trip, you understand?
Okay, so before we invite Dave to start getting stuck into the physiology, if you've got any thoughts or questions about what we've done, what we should be doing, that sort of thing, stuff you'd like to hear us discuss, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Sam Perrin, NTNU. Adam is at Hasik Adam, Hasik Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. And if you want to hear more about the purely ecological stuff that Adam and I do, go and check out ecologyforthemasses.com. All right, so Dave, you want to take us through some aspects of the physiology that you feel are ridiculous?
Sure. So I'm going to be careful here. So I wanted to try and do three different categories to focus on the three primary life stages that I was most interested in of the different alien species. But there's going to be a lot of overlap with parasitism, which is kind of Adam's go-to subject.
Yeah, Adam's a disease / parasite ecologist, so we're going to get into a lot of that next week.
Right, so I'm probably going to leave some of that to sort of discuss with Adam as we go through his ecology section next week. So instead, my primary subjects are going to be, one, I'm just going to do a general overview of xenomorphs. I'm going to do a discussion of acid blood and acid-resistant skin,
which we haven't touched on yet somehow.
And then I'm going to talk about nest building and design, because I think that's a really interesting part, and it feeds into, I love the artwork of H.R. Giger. So it gives me a little bit of room to move.
H.R. Giger.
It is interesting, though, actually, now that you mention that, of all the things, there's nothing really unique about these aliens, despite being the predecessors to a lot of other movie monsters, except for the acid blood.
Yeah, the head shape is pretty weird. The inner jaw is pretty unique, but besides that, they're just kind of these spiky, strange, like wasp demon-looking things that also happen to have acid blood.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a lot. It's just we've also talked about a lot of stuff before. So the first sort of very quick point that I'll touch on in my general issues is going to be rapid metabolism. So the very first film when we see the chest burster erupt from John Hurt and then take off into the background as everybody screams and stands around, it goes from being, you know, 6 inches, 7 inches tall to 7 feet tall in the span of a couple of hours.
Yeah.
Right? Suddenly you come around and they do make comments, you know, it's molted, which molting is a thing. Now, we've talked about rapid growth a couple of times in this show, so I'm not going to go into huge details, but the law of conservation of mass exists everywhere. The creature is not seen consuming any organic material. Growth is a slow process because organizing structures in such a way to make sure that things go where they're supposed to, that Adam doesn't grow a giant leg out of the middle of his forehead.
Not yet.
Are important things that you want to do. And at the end of the day, it just can't get that big.
All it could have possibly been eating is perhaps some sort of yolk sac provided to it by the facehugger. And whatever was within John Hurt's chest. So you can't grow to something that size having eaten almost nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Also touching on that, just the instance of it going from this implanted embryo inside of John Hurt to the emerged chest burster, which is about a foot or 30 centimeters long. It's with the tail, it's fairly large.
Yeah.
But it goes from being what is conceivably a couple cells to this complex, fully formed juvenile organism. And in humans, anyway, that takes months.
Yeah.
But in him, it's a couple hours, maybe 2 days.
Now, in terms of the absence of eyes or echolocation, there's a whole bunch of different theories on how exactly the aliens see or visualize or maneuver around the world. We're not going to get into a lot of details because we've talked about echolocation in both our Tremors and our Quiets episode in long detail. And we've discussed limited visualization.
Just don't worry about it.
Yeah. I think in terms of the...
It's by far the most... It's far from the most interesting question here.
Right. And I mean...
Let's just say that its head has sensory organs.
And the same thing as the hibernation that we've discussed in other episodes, you know, surviving for long periods of time without oxygen or in the vacuum of space. Now, as a interesting quick side note, heat dissipation. So it's repeatedly documented in the second film that they can't see these aliens on their infrared scanners. They have these major problems actually detecting the xenomorphs. This can't be a thing. It's repeatedly documented, you know, they match their ambient temperature. But the thing is, they would still be exhibiting some heat pattern. There would definitely be something that the space marine would be catching. And I know there's a lot out there online about saying, well, you know, maybe they've got a silicon base or they've got other substances that we use in stealth technology for our military. Sure, but they would have to have somewhere that they're achieving that material from. And we don't see them actively, you know, eating their environment. And humans don't really have a large amount of silicon in us. So anything that they're going to be consuming to try and produce that outer exoskeleton, it would be very unlikely that they would be able to produce something that would mask all of their heat signature whatsoever.
But what about them matching the ambient temperature? Could they do it somewhat like a crocodile or an alligator does, whereby in the winter they really, really slow down? So maybe when these things are in space, they really slow down, but once they get to another environment, they can warm up and they can then match it and be more active. Because part of Aliens, I think, they mentioned that, like, they build this hive around the base of the nuclear reactor where it's really hot. And then when the Marines go in to where the drones are, it's also very warm in there. So they can't necessarily not have a heat signature, but it's warm enough in there that they could conceivably have a high enough temperature to be active, and then also simultaneously be matching that temperature so you couldn't see them against the ambient background.
Sure, and I thought about that. There are definitely ways that they could mask the heat signal. They could better mask with their ambient temperature, but they would still be producing enough of a difference that you would be able to catch it on a detailed military infrared scanner.
Gotcha.
Moving on. So the points that I want to talk about, my two primaries, are going to be the acid blood and the acid-resistant skin, which are a key point in both the first and the second film, and then moving on to the hive building. So as a quick overview, in the film, the xenomorphs are repeatedly said to have acidic blood, first encountered when they run into the facehugger that's attached itself to John Hurt, and they attempt to cut one of the digits off, only to release a large amount of what they call molecular acid, which drips its way through the ship, repeatedly burning holes all the way down, until finally it sort of stops. And then in the second film, Bishop ends up making a comment about the acid and saying that it's rendered inert very quickly after it's released by the process of oxidization. Now, both of these points from a chemical perspective, and I am not a chemist by any means, don't really make any sense. So just as a quick overview, acids and bases are simply defined. Acids are chemicals that easily release protons, so hydrogen ions, and bases are those that absorb them. And only certain acids based on their structure will actually react with tissue or metal or other surrounding objects. Now, probably the best acid that you'd want in a situation like this is something like a hydrofluoric acid.
Hydrochloric or hydrofluoric?
Hydrofluoric. Hydrochloric acid is a strong acid, so it's the acid that you find within our stomach. Hydrofluoric acid, though, is a much stronger acid and would show the characteristics that we see, where basically you see dissolution or breakdown when it strikes skin. But it kind of falls into this weird category where, technically based on its chemical structure, so HFH2O, it's technically defined as a weak acid because it continues to hold on to one of its protons. Now, moving on, acids, the basic idea that they work on is with this whole donating protons and taking protons. If you've got a structure that is readily attacking the atomic bonds that make us up, which you do have when you've got a substance that easily dissociates its hydrogen from its primary ion, it means that it's going to be in a situation where it's more likely going to be to disrupt normal atomic bonds and cause normally organized structures to deteriorate. It doesn't cause the molecules to evaporate or break down or anything like that. It just causes the chemical structures to change.
So it's a Wizard of Oz situation.
Exactly. I'm melting. Now, for acids in your stomach, they're a big thing that we use, right? We eat substances, we drop them into our stomach, their chemical structures change, they break apart into their individual pieces, and then they end up moving through. And we actually have a really cool system of cells and structures on the inside of our stomach that both generate acid, and then they also generate this basic mucus. And the whole point is that you generate a organ that is filled with acid, but then you also have a whole bunch of substances that are generated that both protect the lining of your stomach and will neutralize the acid as it comes in contact. So you have this really interesting intrinsic natural balance where you're trying to produce enough acid to dissolve the things that you're eating, but you're also trying to produce enough base to make sure that you don't melt yourself from the inside. And the formation of an ulcer happens when you get a weakening of that mucus layer in one area of the stomach. And as a result, the acid is actually able to attack and burn at that spot, and which is why it causes so much pain, disruption, problems. And it's also why if somebody has a knife wound or damage to the stomach and the acid leaks out into the rest of the body, it's such a painful and slow way to go. So blood can be acidic. It's not, when we're talking acidic, your blood is normally sitting around a pH of like 7.3. And you get variations within that range where you get it can be slightly more basic or more acidic. But a pH of 7 is water. It's about the middle of your pH scale.
It is the middle.
Exactly. Your pH scale is just simply a marker of how readily something absorbs protons or donates protons. So objects that are higher on the pH scale are more basic. Objects that are lower are more acidic. So it makes absolutely no sense to have blood that is acidic, because your blood's primary mechanism is it transports your oxygen, your white blood cells, your protein, your nutrients. It moves everything. It's the superhighway of the body, as Bill Nye loves to say. It would not make any sense to have this substance which is dissolving and breaking down and destroying everything that's in you. Now, most people online and the creators of the alien have also come forward and said there is absolutely no evidence that they have acid for blood. And in fact, most of the hardcore xenomorph gurus have gone the route of saying it makes much more sense that the xenomorphs or the facehuggers actually have pockets underneath the skin where they hold pockets of acid. So a predator attacks, it bites or damages through the skin, and large amounts of acid are released as a defense mechanism. Now, this is possible. You could have pockets underneath the skin. It wouldn't be everywhere, but you could have areas where you have small pockets of acid where the body is actually producing rings of mucus and has some mechanism of siphoning out the neutralized acid when it's been produced in order to keep this supply of acidic material underneath the skin. It would be a hugely energy dramatic process. The stomach takes a lot of energy to do what it does.
It's worse than producing venom.
Right. I mean, it's just you'd be constantly producing and neutralizing acid for the rare chance that you would find yourself in a situation where something would bite you. Now, I can kind of believe that this mechanism might be taking place for the facehuggers. They're fairly defenseless. They seem to be pretty readily destroyed when something comes up. Like, I mean, they get blown to pieces with a machine gun fairly easily. And maybe that might be a cool little evolutionary trait to say, like, hey, we're going to create a couple of pockets of acid to make sure that nothing destroys or fucks with these things when they've attached to a face. And that if something tries to eat them while they're on their process of trying to stick onto a face, something's going to get a mouthful of acid.
Okay.
You see that in this film. Like, if they hadn't all just been standing around and somebody had grabbed that fucking xenomorph and stomped the shit out of it at the very start, movie over. Because that thing is incredibly vulnerable.
Right. Now, I just don't find any reason why, unless it's just a carryover from their juvenile stage, it doesn't make any sense for the adults to have acid. They're an apex predator. They're at the top of the food chain.
Yeah.
I don't imagine there's a lot of things biting and chewing at them unless the planet that they're originally from is crazy fucking hostile.
If anything, I could see it maybe being some kind of autoimmune function, whereby if they get wounded, either in a fight or trying to take down a prey item, that this acid will then cauterize that wound very quickly and seal over any kind of breach from the outside to the inside of their body.
That's a really interesting way to look at it.
It is. The only problem that goes against that...
Don't you do this, Dave.
...is that they repeatedly say in the film that the aliens are resistant to their own acid. That if it sprays on their own skin...
Well, if there's anything we've learned about movie biologists, is that they're fucking garbage.
So, I do like Adam's theory.
Thank you.
Cauterization with acid, though, would take a huge amount of energy to, again, create those pockets. It wouldn't be spurting out in huge amounts. And we do have natural cautery mechanisms. They're called platelets.
And you would have, like, an even distribution of them as well. Like, it'd have to be a really...
Right, and you may have little pockets. I think it makes more sense that the juveniles would have pockets of acid to protect themselves if they're bit or struck. That they put a lot of energy in to protect the young facehuggers. But then once they develop into the giant apex predators, I just don't see any reason why they would keep the acidic traits.
And it'd just be far too costly, because, I mean, they're incredibly aggressive creatures. They would be getting injured all the time. It'd be far too costly to have that constant layer of acid.
Now, it's repeatedly mentioned throughout the film that the aliens are resistant to their own acid. And this kind of makes sense. If you do have pockets of acid, you're not really going to want to get burned by your own acid. And there are ways to make structures that are not acid-proof, but they are acid-resistant. And the best example of this is Breaking Bad, where the very first or second episode where they have the discussion about trying to dissolve a body, and Walter White makes the whole point of saying, don't dissolve it in the bathtub, go and get plastics. So I'm not actually against the xenomorphs having acid-resistant skin. They would have to make changes to it to most likely make their skin non-polar, so it just wouldn't bind, it wouldn't allow the acid to actually stick, it would kind of roll off it. Like waterproof jeans.
Or my waterproof jacket.
So you can definitely create something where the acid would roll off the skin. It would still probably do some molecular damage, but the aliens themselves would actually be fairly acid resistant. So as a quick summary, I think that our xenomorphs could work if they ended up having acid pockets that potentially existed in the adolescence.
Yeah.
That they put a lot of energy into producing these pockets and either lining them with nonpolar compounds, which would still burn, so it doesn't make sense. or more likely lining them with mucus and producing small amounts to try and keep themselves protected long enough that they can actually bind and host, and then producing substances on their skin that would help the acid to roll off or not bind in order to protect them if their skin was in fact punctured and the acid was released.
Yeah.
And Adam is right, it might have secondary cautery properties, which is a really cool idea. It's just, it probably wouldn't be its primary function going forward.
Nah.
All right, we should move on to the hive nest building.
So the xenomorphs in the second film, there's the first scene where the Marines come down to the fusion reactor and they end up finding that the environment has been changed. The walls have all taken on that gothic architecture that stretches down, and now there are these long tunnels with chambers where the colonists have sort of been connected up against the walls in order that they can be impregnated with the next line of xenomorph. And then as the movie goes on, we eventually get to see the lair of the queen. Now, the best example that I can find of a species that modifies its environment, because we have lots, there's lots of ants and birds and other creatures that make these big changes or modifications to their surrounding environments. But by far the coolest, and one of my favorites, are of course the termites, which were a big inspiration for the xenomorph design.
It's like an ant hive. Bees, man. Bees have hives.
Bees.
Now, termites, for those who don't know, live in these big tunneled structures that they build. They tend to stand fairly high. They can be as tall as a human. And interestingly enough...
Or taller.
The termites themselves actually don't live inside of those termite structures. Those big hive skyscrapers, the mounds as they're called. They actually live directly below them. And there's been a whole bunch of theories for the last couple of years as to why they build these, because there's a huge amount of energy that goes into it. The termites actually build these out of particles of soil and their own excrement mixed with their saliva.
I did the same thing last week.
I mean, when I think about my ideal house, that is exactly
just
what I want.
Building it out of your saliva, your shit, and a little bit of dirt.
My own saliva, my own feces. Yeah, that's, I mean, look, it's...
I'm pretty sure the YouTube channel Primitive Skills has an episode where he builds a house out of his own saliva, feces, and mud.
Oh, God.
That's a joke, but probably not.
That is a man keen for an audience, and I respect it.
Now, the typical mound, it's got multiple what are called chimneys, and it seems to have tubes all the way through it, that there are big discussions about why they exist. The primary ones going right at the moment are to allow CO2 to enter and exit in order to keep the colony alive and to take care of the fungal colonies, because termites actually farm fungi that they keep directly below these big termite mounds. The second theory is that it allows for better air circulation in order to keep them cool. Who is right? There's still a lot of debate that's going on. Now, these mounds are strong. They can survive fires, floods, but water can enter...
Hang on, are we talking about termites or aliens at the moment?
We're talking about termites still. They have these big, strong mounds that they built, and in fact, the mounds seem to be so important to them that if you come over and you puncture a hole in one of them, within 5 minutes, workers will swarm out of the hole with a whole bunch of soldiers that protect the workers, in order that the workers can then basically close the hole back up and that everybody then moves back inside of these things.
Termites are incredible.
Yeah, when I was 9 years old, I went on a road trip around Australia with my parents, my sister. And we get into these parts that are way out, you know, very far from civilization, and you have these just massive mounds along the side of the road. And, you know, we'd stop for a piss or to have a look at the sites or whatever. And every now and then we just decided, fuck it, pick up a rock, chuck it at one of these mounds, and just watch what had happened afterwards. It's incredible.
Yeah, they come out in huge numbers, they build it, they give you the finger, yeah. And then they return back inside.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty much. They just form this middle finger that rises up out of the mound.
They've got incredibly complex structures which allow them to identify where holes form in the mound, so they can identify airflow and carbon dioxide. And these are reinforced against rain, floods, other things like that. It's the coolest thing in the world. And when applying it to the xenomorphs, I think that they're probably taking on a similar idea. We see that they've drastically changed the environment, and there's multiple points made that they are trying to keep the nest as warm as possible. And I'm wondering whether or not it's not for incubation of the eggs and for protection of the queen.
Yeah.
Because we know that the eggs don't activate in the first film until John Hurt comes along. And I'm wondering if they have an ambient detection to heat. That basically there is a large enough heat source that is close by that activates the eggs and allows the young to be released. And that's why they've stayed dormant for so long.
It could also be, like, vibrations.
It has to be some kind of heat source from possibly a mammalian-type organism. They go onto this more in, like, the books and some of the games you see, but whenever they have these colonists or any kind of victims strung up along the wall,
yeah.
they put an egg right in front of them, which then opens up when it senses the human.
Okay.
It's most likely that they are changing the environment around them by building these structures in order to affect the humidity, the carbon dioxide, the oxygen. They're basically terraforming.
Yep.
They're creating their own environment and modifying it to try and make it more amenable for the life that they want to build. What they are making this out of, I don't know, but they do appear to be excreting it. We see that the xenomorphs are walking around and they produce large quantities of saliva all the time. It's likely that the drones that we're seeing are using that to mix with whatever resources they have around them in order to build their nest, which is another termite thing. Multiple researchers have basically said termites are capable of growing anywhere that there is soil and water.
Okay.
That they will incorporate grass, they will incorporate other dead insects, they will use whatever they can to build their mounds. And the xenomorphs are most likely taking on similar characteristics. When Asshole Sam walked along and threw a rock at this nest, the first thing that termites...
I was nine, man. Fuck
the first off. Thing that termites did when they found that there was a hole in their nest is actually, as they're running, they fill their mouths with dirt, and then they run over to the nest where they can start building.
God, you social organisms are incredible.
Right. I've got to imagine there's a similar mechanism. We see that the xenomorph are drawn when the machine gun fire starts to go off and is damaging parts of the nest. Now, whether or not they're reacting to the death of a young one or whether or not they're just simply reacting to commotion within the hive, they are all drawn in large numbers towards that site of damage and commotion.
They're also hanging out there. They're just in the wall itself. They're hiding amongst that matrix of material they've created.
Which is the other question is, do they modify the environment in order to better camouflage themselves within their own nest as well?
And it also begs the question of, like, and we'll get into this a bit more next week, like, how aggressive are they? Because we've always seen the aliens as, like, incredibly aggressive, these really vicious creatures. But is that just because they've perceived humans as coming into their habitat and, you know, fucking with them?
I mean, they do seek them out at the base. They come and readily get them, and in fact, they go through welded doors, they climb their way through vents.
But we're in very close proximity to their hive.
Fair enough.
But even outside of that, in the first movie, an alien, the alien by itself is solo. Yeah. There's no hive, there's no other, you know, conspecifics, other members of its own species around. It is seeking out these humans and taking them. And in the deleted scenes of the first movie, Ripley finds a small version of the hive that it has built, and it has put, like, Dallas, the captain of the ship, it has put him into the wall in the matrix of the same kind of material. So it seems to have this programming to build a nest, seek out hosts, bring them back, and then possibly it can turn into a queen itself, or it just has this programming, even without a queen, to try to build a hive itself.
Which is a big part of hive culture. So in the Starship Troopers episode, I ended up discussing a group of ants that had fallen through into a Russian bunker and were stuck living there. In the paper, they end up discussing that the ants, even though there was no queen, there was no organizational structure, the ants that fell down continued to actually build nest structures. They built an entire ant's nest because the mechanism was so hardwired into them that they just kept doing what they were programmed to do.
Yep.
Okay. So we think this thing, the one in the first movie, is just, well, it's got nothing else to do. So it's just like, fuck it.
It's just a drone. I think it's just following programming. It's hunting down local food sources. It's starting to build a nest.
Yeah.
And it's building all those anticipation that there is a queen there. Now, that leads me into my second part of sort of hive design. Now, everybody assumes that the termite queen is in fact the ruler of the nest. And there's a huge amount of controversy surrounding this, but most researchers actually say she's a captive. She's kept within this chamber in the middle of the termite mound.
She's a brood mare.
She's producing large amounts of eggs. There are other organisms that carry and move her around. But at the end of the day, she's just supplied with food. She's not making any decisions. The nest is built around her, but it's just built around her like she's the central reactor, which is similar to how the xenomorphs are building their nest. Now, side point that's really cool, termite queens typically live between 25 to 50 years. They're the oldest termite in the colony.
Yep.
Their peak production is for 10 years. They just produce like nonstop. And when the queen dies, the whole way that a new colony actually forms is she produces a pheromone the entire time that she's alive that actually stops the other larvae from changing into females, from turning into new queens. And this is kind of how a new colony is started. So males and females will eventually leave their colony. They grow wings, they sprout, they move to a new location. And at that point, a new queen starts. There's usually a couple of early females that are kept on in the nest that also produce some eggs until the numbers get large enough, at which point the females are then repurposed or die, and they leave the central queen behind. And I've got to imagine that a similar mechanism is working here, that potentially one of those eggs contained a queen, or that in the absence of a queen, if there are enough of these larvae that are activated, one of them simply morphs into a new female and starts producing within the central of the hive. Because everybody has had these big discussions for years about, you know, well, how would the xenomorphs survive if that queen egg had been destroyed? I don't think there has to be a queen egg.
No, yeah.
I think that these things are so hyperplastic, they're so able to adapt to whatever situation comes around, that I think, and kind of that deleted scene from the first movie is kind of proof of this, where it builds this nest, it is setting up the structures to for a queen to exist in, there isn't a queen, and then some kind of switch in the brain goes off, it's like, okay, there's a hive, there's no queen, time for me to be that queen.
Yeah.
And it grows and it changes, starts laying eggs so they can then continue the cycle.
Exactly. And so I think something similar is probably taking place. Now, the only disappointing part that I have when I was watching films, and they do get into in the comic books, is you do get to see other variants of the xenomorphs as the colony starts to grow.
Yeah.
And look, there's others in the movies as well. There's the dog alien.
Originally it was supposed to be a bison.
A cow, yeah.
A cow, yeah.
And, you know, there's that weird fucking hybrid, and there's all sorts of weird shit in Prometheus and Covenant, so we'll get into that next week, yeah.
So those are my physiology subjects for this week.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird shit about this, but yeah, I think those are the two that we haven't really covered in any way before.
No.
These termites, these guys are not going to put up much of a fight, right? I mean, we're talking about pushovers, right?
Not really, kid. They're 5 times our size, and they shoot acid from their foreheads.
Wait a minute. Let's not get, we're being too hasty here. These guys sound like bruisers. How how are you figuring on beating them?
Superior numbers, kid. Overwhelm their defenses. Kill their queen.
Fellas, you're being a little extreme, I feel. Why don't we just try and influence their political process with campaign contribution?
All right, well, look, Dave, have you got a vet PSA for us this week?
I do, and this is one that I think both Adam and Sam are going to want to contribute to this, because I've been seeing this a lot lately. There is a huge difference between domesticated and tame animals. I've been seeing a lot of videos of people taking raccoons into their house, or videos of Russian bear
you
can rent that comes to birthday parties. They've got a big video circulating of a kid sitting next to it and like pouring tea into a cup, or all these videos of this person helped raise a wolf, this person helped raise a lion, and now they're friends.
This person has foxes in her home, yeah.
Domestication is the act of actually taking a species and over multiple generations selecting those who have a better behavior set that aligns with what humans want, which is where you get the modern day dog, an animal that is super dedicated towards humans, that will not usually bite you.
Used to them, dependent on them.
Right. There are lots of stories that circulate online of people taking in tame animals that turn on them. And we see this a lot primarily with our primates, where you hear horror stories about someone that was rich and famous and adopted a chimp to live in their house.
Ooh, rip their face off.
Only to find the chimp turned on them. And when chimps turn on you, they turn on you bad. So the big thing that I think I wanted to get at, and I know that we've talked about this lots, but I'm worried that this idea is starting to fade.
Don't adopt a chimpanzee.
Wild animals are wild. And it's not that there's anything wrong with them. It's not that they're doing anything nasty or evil. That porcupine that, you know, got your dog, and now your dog has quills, it wasn't because the porcupine was evil. It's just a wild animal.
So your dog's a fuckwit.
And at the end of the day,
probably called it names.
Please be...
hit on its wife.
Be careful and don't try to adopt a raccoon. If you find yourself an owl or a large bird, there are lots of veterinary shelters for wildlife organizations that will take these animals in, will try to nurse them back to health and get them going again. We see numerous attempts of humans at trying to take these creatures into their own home to try and take care of them or try and raise them with the idea that they're going to become a pet. There are reasons why this doesn't work. It's really harmful for the environment and it's really harmful for the animal. And in many cases, it's really harmful for you.
Yep.
We had this one when I was much younger again, around the same age that I was throwing stones at termite mounds.
Asshole.
There was an injured possum that was on our front doorstep. And we took it in, you know, we nested in a box, that sort of thing. And then we took it to the RSPCA, which is the Australian's Royal Society for the Protection and Care of Animals, I think. And I was just like, Mum, can we keep it? Mum, can we keep it? Mum, can we keep it? And Mum was just like, no!
You fuckwit.
We can't. It's a fucking possum. Yeah, you dumbass.
There's been this video going around of these parents who open the door and there's like 32 raccoons sitting on their front step. And the mom is like encouraging the daughter to pet one of the raccoons. And the daughter finally does. And the raccoon bites her hard.
Yeah.
Rabies is kind of a thing within the raccoon population.
Yeah, speaking of raccoon scenes, have you guys watched the TV show of What We Do in the Shadows?
Yeah. Yeah, I have. Yeah.
It's so good. There's an amazing scene involving a pack of raccoons.
Or just when he gets captured and he gets put into the veterinarian because he's a bat and they think he has rabies.
Our roommate Leslo is now caged and inside the animal shelter.
We need to rescue him.
Okay, anyway, yeah, is that all day?
That's everything.
Nice. All right, well, Adam, you want to sign us off?
Absolutely. As we say at the end of every episode of Cinematica and Amelia, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
There's movement all over the place! 5 meters, man! 4!
Aliens. This time, it's war.